It's been almost exactly a year since demonstrators gathered in Charlottesville, Virginia for a Unite the Right rally. You remember torches, chants of Jews will not replace us, counter demonstrations, and a car plowing into a crowd, killing one woman and injuring several others. This year, Charlottesville said no, so the organizers want to demonstrate in Washington, D.C. This is the context in which we talk more broadly today about hate in the United States by talking about the stories of people who have experienced hate, often in physical terms. Arjun Singh Sethi is the editor of a new book called American Hate, Survivors Speak Out. Arjun Singh Sethi is a civil rights lawyer, law professor, community activist, and obviously a writer. His writing has appeared in The Guardian and Politico and The Washington Post, among other outlets. His faculty appointments are at Georgetown and Vanderbilt universities. Arjun Sethi, thanks for joining us today on The Exchange.
Thank you so much for having me.
There's another job I didn't mention. You're on a committee. In fact, you co-chair a committee at the American Bar Association, which also relates to this work. Tell us about that.
Sure. I am the co-chair of the American Bar Association's Committee on Homeland Security, Terrorism, and Treatment of Enemy Combatants. And in connection with that, I make sure that policies in the United States are consistent with the spirit of civil and human rights. And in connection with that work, I've actually served as a legal observer at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba.
Oh, so you've actually been down to the camp and everything?
I have, absolutely. I have been a legal observer at proceedings at the base.
Mm-hmm. You don't hold back in your intro to American Hate, Survivors Speak Out. And you write, this country was built on a hate crime. Can you expand that a bit?
Sure. Here's what I would say about the present political moment and how it relates to our history. Hate preexisted Donald Trump. It will endure after him. But it has nevertheless intensified in this moment. So when I say hate pre-existed Trump, a lot of people fail to recognize and understand that this country was built on a hate crime. The decimation and destruction of Native indigenous communities, and really furthered on additional hate crimes and atrocities, which include things like slavery, mass incarceration, Jim Crow, and the like. So one of the reasons I think we're having a difficult time understanding this moment is that we are forgetting our history. We are not learning from our history. And again, we have to understand that part of the reason that Donald Trump came to power was that he catalyzed a lot of the ugly forces that have really been part of this country for as long as it has existed.
So you think if we'd been more honest about the racist beginnings of our country, that we might have been doing better at dealing with racism among us now, or we wouldn't have as much of it or something?
Absolutely. I think if we had honest, frank conversations about racism, bigotry, misogyny all along, then we wouldn't have had an emboldening of hate. We wouldn't have marches like we saw in Charlottesville and what we're expecting in D.C. this weekend. And I think it is a collective failing that we haven't had those conversations and that we actually haven't sat down with Native communities and with Black communities and really let them tell their stories.
You know, it was interesting because I was reading, oddly enough, just this morning, George Will's column was about Oregon and about the trends that Oregon has gone through over the years. It gets derided by George Will and others as a liberal bastion, the Portland area anyway. And yet this is a state that was ruled by the Ku Klux Klan in the 1920s. And I wonder, though, if what happens is once we manage to sweep the people who do seem racist out of power, if we just would rather not deal with it any further, and it's like, oh, good, that's over. Is that the part of the contributing factor here, you think?
You know, progress requires struggle. And that's not me. That's Frederick Douglass. While I think it's a good idea, and I think that, I mean, let me phrase it this way. Progress requires struggle, and there is no question that we are making incremental progress and that we have made incremental progress. But again, to understand this moment, to understand Trump's rise to the presidency, we really have to understand that, again, he mobilized and catalyzed a lot of these really ugly, dark forces, whether it's racism, misogyny, and the like. So I don't think it's enough to just wait for racists to die, if that's sort of what's being suggested. I think that we have to have recurring, regular, difficult conversations about those forces because it manifests in different ways. So speaking very concretely, The book very intentionally captures the many ways in which hate manifests in this country, which is why you will find stories of bullying, cyber trolling, vandalism and arson of houses of worship, and murder. So to tackle all of the different manifestations of hate, I don't think we can just wait for racists to die. I think we have to have very difficult conversations. And we also have to understand that racism means different things. It's not just hurting somebody on account of their identity. It's also bullying somebody. It's also whether you give somebody who's white the benefit of the doubt versus somebody who's black, etc.
Have you faced a lot of acts of hate in your own life?
So I'm a sick American, and I don't know how many listeners know sick Americans, but I can be readily identified by some of my articles of faith, which include my long hair, which I cover with a turban and a beard. Sick Americans have historically been vulnerable to bullying, hate, profiling, and hate violence in this country. In connection with this book, I was nearly driven off the road in Tulsa, Oklahoma. In Kalispell, Montana, I was stared down by a cashier and a customer. And on the campus of American University, I was intentionally misdirected by a student.
Okay, so that would be a yes, not surprisingly. Arjun Sethi is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is American Hate, Survivors Speak Out. We'll begin to delve into some of the stories of the survivors and the process that Arjun used to put the book together. Back on the Jefferson Exchange with Arjun Sethi and you in a minute 10. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Arjun Singh Sethi, who is the editor of a new book called American Hate, Survivors Speak Out, 13 stories of people who were beat up or bullied or in some cases killed because of the difference that they represented to other people and weren't disliked because of it, to put it mildly. You can join us on the Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. We have mentioned the name of Donald Trump several times in the program as being responsible for letting people know it was okay to be racist again, is I think the thesis here. You say that Trump told us who he was a long time ago, and you tick off several incidents, Arjun.
Absolutely.
I mean, what are some of those incidents?
Yeah, so, you know, in the book I say Trump told us who he was a long time ago, and it's time we believed him. And I cite numerous examples of Trump's racist past. So he bought full-page newspaper ads calling for the execution of the Central Park Five, five young men of color who were arrested for attacking a jogger who were later exonerated. As a casino owner, he ordered black employees off his casino floors during his visits and called them lazy, secretly funding anti-Native ads featuring pictures of cocaine and syringes, saying things like Elizabeth Warren is Pocahontas, calling Mexican undocumented immigrants rapists, ridiculing Chinese and Japanese trade negotiators using broken English, defending two white men who assaulted a Latino man as passionate supporters, criticizing a judge because he was Mexican. I mean, these are just examples. I mean, reportedly, in discussions in the Oval Room, and these are discussions that have been raised in the media. He reportedly claimed that Haitians all have AIDS, Nigerians would never go back to their huts, and Haiti and African nations were, excuse my English, whole countries.
Bannon is mentioned in here too, of course, and he said not a badge of honor. When people not only think they're not doing something wrong, but very much on the right track, how much harder is the kind of work you do?
You know, it's really hard. And in the conclusion, I say that I cite a study that found that a majority of white Americans feel that they are the victims of discrimination. And really, they are not the victims of discrimination. Truthfully, what's happening in this country is that we have had civil rights progress. We have tried to level the playing field. So as the playing field has been leveled, they feel like they are losing some of their privileges. So that's really what this is about.
So, all right, so this, seeing the rise of hatred is not good news, but it is certainly news. And I wonder if it's actually somewhat better to at least have it out there, to know what's going on.
You know, in some cases, I think his election and this environment has spurred important conversations. And I think that's important. But I will also say that his election, his policies, and his rhetoric has also spurred a lot of acts of hate. And that's what the book is about. Again, bullying, cyber trolling, vandalism, assault, murder. There have been tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, of hate crimes in this country that have been aggravated and in some ways spurred by this president.
All right, so here's one of the first real surprises in the book, reliable statistics. You say the FBI data on hate crimes is grossly incomplete. So it collects it, but there's something missing. What's missing?
So thank you for raising that. According to the FBI, there was 6,000 hate crimes in the year 2016. But if you look at a survey like the National Crime Victimization Survey, there were as many as 250,000 hate crimes that year and every year in this country. So why the gap? The gap exists because the FBI relies on voluntary reporting by local law enforcement, not mandatory reporting. And as a consequence, most law departments across this country, police departments across this country, don't bother reporting. Or when they report zero hate crimes because they want to pretend like their backyard doesn't have an issue with hate, which is why the FBI data is so incomplete.
Arjun Singh Sethi is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. He is the editor of a project called American Hate, Survivors Speak Out, out in paperback book form, 13 stories of people and families who have been rocked by hate in America. You do cite some stats here, and with the larger number, I think, comes from groups like the Southern Poverty Law Center, about which there is some criticism that SPLC goes too far in identifying people and groups as haters. I wonder what you think about that criticism of them.
I think the Southern Poverty Law Center does extraordinary work, and I think they deserve to be praised and celebrated for the work they did immediately after the election. There were more than, I believe, 1,000 incidents of hate in just the first 30 days that they tracked following the election. And I can't speak to their internal processes because I don't know them, but I will tell you that community activists and other national organizations have full faith and confidence in their work and in the staff there, and so do I. And I am grateful for the work they do. And I think every American should consult their work and learn about their important research on hate, discrimination, and violence in this country.
So, Arjun, now to the stories in the book. Did you find them through the SPLC, or were there the things that people related to you, or how did you go about collecting the stories that ended up in the book?
So it was definitely a process. My connection to survivors was through local community organizations. They are the gateway to survivors, and they're on the front lines working on these issues every day. So typically what I would do is I would reach out to local community organizations, either saying, can you connect me to a survivor? Do you have a suggestion for someone to include in the book? And I would kind of just take it from there. It was also important to me to have geographic diversity. It was important to me to have a diversity of voices in this moment, communities of color, Native persons, Black persons, Muslim, Jewish, queer, trans, refugee, undocumented voices. I wanted to have all of them in the book. So I have all those perspectives. It was also important to me, like I said before, to capture the spectrum of hate, which is, again, why you will find stories of bullying, vicious online trolling, the desecration of houses of worship, assault and murder.
So, and then what was it like then for you to collect the details and then go over them again in the editing process?
It was tough, but I will tell you that the survivors I met are brave. They are courageous. They all wanted to have their stories told. So what typically would happen was I would meet with a survivor in their home or their house of worship. I would then transcribe the interview, and I would then work with the survivor to include and feature their testimonial in the book. And they had the final say as to what was included.
You bring up fake news in the intro to the book. People accuse some of these victims of misreporting what happened to them?
Absolutely. People don't understand that survivors who come forward do so at great risk to themselves. Sometimes they're attacked again. Sometimes they're trolled online. Sometimes they're accused of fabrication. And one of the reasons that I wrote this book is because hate is real and hate hurts. And I wanted these survivors to have another platform to tell their stories.
Let us take a call here. We have Anne and Eugene on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange. We're talking to Arjun Sethi about his book, American Hate, Survivors Speak Out. Hi, Anne.
Thank you. So in 1964, after the passage of the Civil Rights Laws, Republican Party decided to go after the racist vote. And then in 1973, after the Supreme Court decision on Roe versus Wade, they decided to go for the sexist vote. So, and then in the 80s, they decided to go for the homophobia vote. And that's been their constituency ever since then. Donald Trump is not an outlier. Donald Trump is the mainstream of the Republican Party because it's no longer just a political party. It's become a cult. And I'd like to know what your author thinks of that.
All right, Anne, thank you for the call. Appreciate that. Arjun?
So that's a good question. And pivoting back to a question that was asked earlier, right? This country was built on a hate crime. So I fundamentally agree that forces like homophobia, sexism, misogyny, racism have been around for a long time. They often manifest in different ways, but there is no question that Trump's politics are mainstream. I think I wouldn't even call it a cult. I would call it mainstream because he won. And though his approval ratings are not as high as other presidents, he still enjoys a decent approval rating. So I share some of your concerns that there are these forces that are part of the historical experience of this country that often get manipulated and catalyzed and emboldened for political gain.
We are talking to Arjun Singh Sethi. He is the editor of the book American Hate, Survivors Speak Out. There are 13 different stories in the book about people who have survived hate crimes as they understand them, and you can join the conversation on the Exchange, as Anne just did, 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So let's get into the stories. We start with the travel ban, and Asma Al-Bukai, I hope I'm doing her name justice, from Syria, living in Idaho. What happened to her family in Syria?
You know, she didn't talk much about it just because of privacy issues, but her family was a target during the Civil War. Her husband was murdered. Her sons were at risk of being kidnapped, so she fled. And she describes in really painful detail the long journey from Damascus by bus all the way to Cairo. And then talks about how many months later, she was resettled in Boise, Idaho. And Asma was the first Syrian refugee to ever be resettled in that state.
There's a very interesting point she makes. Refugees can't choose where they'll be resettled, even the country.
You know, and that's a point that I don't think people realize. The United States accepted her. So when Donald Trump gets on television and says, we don't know who these people are, we don't know who these Syrians and refugees are, Asma talks about how she had almost a dozen interviews with all kinds of officials, including U.S. officials, and how they looked at her paperwork, and how they looked at the paperwork of her two sons, and how based on that, they decided to accept her.
Now, Asma's son asked if he should lie about being a Muslim. And why did we ask such a question?
He asked that question because one day he was walking in downtown Boise and somebody came up to him and said, "Are you Muslim?" When the boy responded yes, he was punched to the ground. And the boy was despondent and asked his mother later, "The next time somebody asks me if I'm Muslim, should I lie? Because I don't want to be hurt again." And Asma bravely told her son that you should be proud to be Muslim. And anybody who fails to see that is no friend of yours and is no friend of this country.
Asma says that people ask her if she'll stop wearing the hijab, the Muslim head covering, which she wears all the time. And what is her answer?
Her answer is that her hijab is part of who she is. It's part of her life. She also has this, you know, beautiful line where she says that the hijab, because she wears it on her head, hugs her face every day. And it just gives her comfort and it gives her joy. And it's something that she really celebrates as part of her identity.
So let's move on to the next story. Taylor Dumpson is next. She got to be 13 years old before she heard the N-word, and she had a particularly strong response to the shooting death of Trayvon Martin in Florida. How did she take that?
So Taylor Dumpson is an extraordinary young woman. She was the first black woman to ever be elected student body president at American University. And then the day she took office, nooses were found hanging across campus. In many ways, the decision to run for office at AU was spurred
by... At American University, was spurred by
the death of Trayvon Martin, because she talks in her own words about how that moment changed her life. Because it was really in that moment that she started to realize that a lot of the institutions in this country that she was born or grew to trust really didn't serve black folks like her. And it ended up being this moment where she started looking around her and realizing that blacks people experience inequities in every facet of American life, whether it's in the classroom, in universities, housing, the income divide, or of course, you know, police profiling, acts of brutality, and mass incarceration.
You know, I don't want to name names, but there are other university campuses where I can more readily imagine something like nooses showing up the day after a black student gets elected student body president. But American University, I guess I'm really surprised by this. Are a lot of other people as well?
I think it just goes to show how mainstream racism, white supremacy, and anti-blackness are. Here's a young woman who was elected student body president by the students at that school in a Democratic election, 4 miles from the White House, maybe six? And nooses are found hanging across campus. There have actually been, I believe, more than 150 incidents in 2017 alone of nooses and white supremacist flyers being found across campuses across this country. So it's a quotidian problem, and we need to treat it like one.
What kind of support did Taylor Dumpson get from the American University administration? I mean, how did they back her up or not?
I would encourage everyone to read that story, because she has a very specific take as to what happened. In some ways, she feels like she was immediately supported right after the incident. But she also talks about how she felt exploited. She talked about how she and some of her colleagues, diverse colleagues, organized their own press conference to speak to the media, but how, unbeknownst to her, the university had gone above her, arranged their own press conference, and basically co-opted hers, and how she was basically forced to read a statement that they had prepared, and how she felt at that moment that she couldn't say no to the school, because if she said no to the school, she would have been perceived as a noncompliant, angry black woman.
Taylor does say in her part of the book that she does think free speech has its limits. I mean, we talked about, you know, some of the time, place, manner restrictions. It's a very sore point on college campuses right now, though. So what kinds of limits does she have in mind?
Again, there are numerous perspectives in the book that describe the impact of hate speech on their lives. And some of what Oh, I was hearing some noise. Some of what Taylor is describing on AU is basically the threats that she received. So she talks about how after, Black Americans and Black folks had been killed by police, people would say on campus that they deserved it. So she talks about how hate speech on campus impacts her ability to learn, impacts her ability to grow. And so she says we need to have a real conversation about hate speech in this country and how it affects students of color at universities.
The book is called American Hate, Survivors Speak Out. We'll come back and talk more with the editor, Arjun Sethi, in just a few moments here on the Jefferson Exchange. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking about a subject that is unpleasant to talk about in America today, and that is racism. But it has been with us since the beginning, as our guest points out, and is very much with us today. Arjun Singh Sethi is the editor of a project called American Hate, Survivors Speak Out, a paperback book featuring 13 stories of people who've been exposed to hatred that went from verbal to far beyond that, and actually in one case led to death. You can join us on the exchange as we talk about racism in America and what can be done about it. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email. It's jx@jeffnet.org. So here's where we get into the story of the Jabara family, which is a bit of a twist here because they're from the Middle East, but they are Christian. What brought them to Tulsa, Oklahoma, Arjun?
The Jabaras fled Lebanon because of the Civil War, and they resettled in Tulsa, Oklahoma. And their story is absolutely tragic. Khalid Jabara is an Arab American who was murdered in August 2016, just months before the election of Donald Trump. And he was murdered by their next door neighbor, a man who had previously menaced and harassed the family, calling them things like dirty Arabs, dirty Muslims, and ISIS. And months before the neighbor killed Khalid Jabara, he actually ran over his mother with a car, Haifa Jabara. He was arrested for that crime, was then allowed out on bond, no conditions, returned home next door to the family he terrorized, and then months later killed Khalid Jabara on his doorstep.
Some of the details of this are just kind of blow your mind because, for one thing, to find out that hate crime, there is such a category in Oklahoma, and yet it's a misdemeanor.
Thank you for pointing that out. There are really hate crime legislation across this country. It's a patchwork. Every state has their own hate crime law, except for five states. And one of the issues that we repeatedly run into is that many state hate crime laws aren't complete. So they only cover misdemeanor offenses. They don't cover felony offenses, or they only cover certain protected classifications, but not others. So this is another example for why we need a comprehensive hate crime law that covers not just all manners of identity, but also applies to, you know, misdemeanors and felonies.
And so Haifa was hit by a car by the person who ended up murdering Khalid Jabara. And what has become of the person who did those things?
He was recently found guilty of murder, and he's in prison.
Have the Jabaras discussed at all getting out of Tulsa, wanting to move to a different place?
I don't think so. Rami Jabara lives in Texas. Victoria Jabara lives locally, and Haifa with her husband Munna live locally in Tulsa. I think they plan to stay in Tulsa. That's where they built their home. And I will tell you, when I sat with the family in their home, right, just 10 feet away from the porch where, you know, Khalid was shot dead, Haifa said to me, "Arjun, I will never leave this home because this is where my son grew up. This is where he played. Where you're sitting right now, that's where he used to type on his computer. And part of him will always be here, and I will never leave this house."
Wow, that is a very powerful story indeed. Again, Arjun Singh Sethi is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. The book is American Hate, Survivors Speak Out. Here is a call from Karen in Mount Shasta. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Yes, I just wondered if he had any feeling that the, you know, we've suppressed all of the we've had to be politically correct for 20 years, and if that's kind of kept this burbling under the surface, and then Trump comes along and kind of opens up the pressure cooker. I just wondered if he thought that had any effect on it.
Karen, hang on a second. When you say politically correct speech, I just wonder what that connotes to you.
Oh, just everything. I mean, the last 20 years, you couldn't say anything about anything. I mean, just in general language, even changing the names of agencies, you know, it's not unemployment, it's employment agency. And I mean, just from all sides, everything, you know, you're not able to talk about anything that's not hunky-dory and happy, you know, and talking about it is what gets it out and releases all. I think it's just kind of kept it suppressed so long that when somebody comes along and says it's okay, you know, it just kind of like blew the top off.
I guess what I'm asking, though, is like, did somebody specifically say, don't talk to me about that? Don't say those things to me?
No, not at all. It's just, I mean, haven't you felt that you have to say things politically correct? You can't. Well, I mean, even that people are, you know, you hear it even today, like somebody loses weight and then there's all the people that support that. Oh, great. And then there's the people that say, oh, gosh, well, then she's making fun of people that are heavy. You know, I mean, it's just like you can't say anything without offending people. And everybody's offended all the time instead of, you know, I'm Polish and I love Polish jokes. I really feel like a lot of times that's the way I think, you know.
Mm-hmm. All right. Thank you for the clarification. I was just trying to get to the clarification of when you say politically correct.
Yeah, I just think there's no tolerance for that anymore.
Okay. Thanks for that, Karen. Appreciate that. So weigh in here, Arjun, if you would, about whether we've suppressed speech so much that people felt like they had to get it out, and Donald Trump appealed to those people.
You know, so I actually have a line in the book that speaks to this exact point, and here it is. The incorrigible political correctness that has become a hallmark of our lives must be replaced with an unwavering commitment to dialogue, truth, and accountability. So in some ways, I agree with the caller. I do think that a lot of these forces have been under the surface for a long time, whether it's racism, misogyny, sexism, Islamophobia, anti-Semitism. And Trump played on those forces as a demagogue. So I think it's precisely because we have not been having a lot of those very difficult conversations that we need to have about our past, about our history, that allowed Trump to come to power.
You know, it certainly makes sense in some realms where, you know, there's terms you don't want to use anymore. You don't want to use the N-word or, you know, anything that is derogatory to another person. So in that way, what people would identify as politically correct speeches is really just getting into a zone of politeness. But then some of the other stuff that Karen brought up, though, the idea about talking about people's weight or appearance and stuff, it seems like there are lots of places where people feel like they can't talk, but it doesn't seem like that would necessarily cause a resentment so large that people would feel like they had to, like, trash the whole system.
Yeah, I mean, I can't speak to the example about weight, but what I can comfortably say is that as a society, we have not had difficult conversations about things like white privilege, anti-Black racism, homophobia, transphobia, and the like. And because we have not had those difficult conversations, because we have not done the difficult work to root them out, they're there. And they're there to be exploited. And I think that's a lot of what happened in this moment.
I want to bring up one more of the vignettes before we go, and that's Jeanette Vizguerra, who's an activist and is undocumented. I mean, why did she come, and why has she stayed, and what has been happening to her?
Sure. So Jeanette Vizguerra is a undocumented Latinx mother of four. And her story in the book actually begins with a conversation around the dinner table where she tells her three U.S.-born children that ICE might one day come to their house and rip their family apart because she's undocumented and they were born here. So she talks about how she decided to take sanctuary in a house of worship during the Trump administration because that was the only way she felt like she could actually stay in this country. Months after being in sanctuary, she was able to get an extension of her status. So she's in the United States. She is still organizing against, you know, cruel immigration policies, including these brutal immigration raids, the separation and caging of immigrant families. And she's really an extraordinary example of resilience and hope.
You found a lot of examples and people of many, many different ethnic backgrounds, didn't you? And it sounds like it wasn't very hard to find examples.
It was hard. It was hard. This book required absolutely everything I had, and I was working on it 24/7. I was thinking about it all the time. But again, my gateway to these survivors was without a doubt community organizations. Even Jeanette, I connected to Jeanette through the National Domestic Workers Alliance. They're more of a national organization, but they do extraordinary work in organizing and legal advocacy in support of undocumented organizers, undocumented workers, immigrants, domestic workers, and all kinds of other vulnerable communities.
I notice you say it was an honor to help the people in the book tell their stories.
Yeah, because, you know, survivors come forward at great risk to themselves. And really what I'm trying to do with the book is just give them another platform to heal, but also to tell their stories, to chronicle what happened to them. You know, I've been in touch numerous times with the family of, you know, Khalid Jabara, and sometimes in their emails to me, they say, you know, thanks for keeping Khalid's memory alive. And I can't tell you what that means to me.
So I notice a term appears in the book that we only began using on the program a couple of years ago, the idea of allies, people who are not in the group targeted, but who want to stand with them. So what do you recommend for people who want to be allies for the people being abused, especially since anybody who takes up this fight has to be aware of the fact that confronting racism has cost some people their lives?
There is a lot. If and when hate strikes, support survivors, both in the immediate aftermath, but continue to check on them as time passes. Support community local organizations who do this work every day. Make sure your state has a strong hate crime law. Encourage state representatives to invite survivors and impacted communities to testify and share their stories in town forums, in state legislatures. Encourage community town halls. We've seen extraordinary examples of communities coming together in the wake of hate, holding town halls, talking about how hate and racism is impacting their community. Don't wait for hate to strike. We've seen cities across the country hold town halls and community gatherings preparing for the possibility that white supremacists could one day come to their town. Rally, organize. When survivors and their communities march in front of courthouses, in front of state legislators, show up. Center them. Listen to them.
You know, it's interesting that you mentioned in the book the incident in Portland where two people died a couple of years ago. Talesian Namkai Meche grew up in the town where we're based. And so, you know, when people hear stories like that, I guess they think, well, this is somebody who stood up against racists and look what happened to him. So, I mean, this needs to be a sort of a fearless proposition, it sounds like.
You know, you're bringing up the story of Destiny Mangum and Walia Muhammad. They were the two young black women who were aboard a train in Portland, Oregon, when three upstanders intervened and two of them lost their lives. And it's an extraordinary story, and it's a painful, a really hurtful one. You know, when it comes to bystanders and upstanders, people have to do what they are most comfortable with. Two men that day made the most extraordinary sacrifice, and they are American heroes. They are. And I hope we will remember them for a long time to come. But really, in moments like that, allies have to do what they're comfortable with. There are groups that actually work on upstander, bystander training. There are wonderful materials online, wonderful even 3 to 4 minute videos that you can watch that teach you how to de-escalate, how to divert attention, how to protect yourself and those who are being targeted from harm. So there are also programs in place to actually learn how to help people in moments like that.
And Arjun Sethi, before we go, where will you be spending this weekend with the chance of the Unite to the Right rally in Washington?
I will actually be in D.C., hopefully participating in the counter-protest.
All right. Well, I wish you the best of luck. The book is called American Hate, Survivors Speak Out. It won't make you happy, but it will make you knowledgeable. Arjun Sethi is the editor of the title. Thanks so much for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
All right. Take care.